Hello everybody, and thank you for joining us for this class tonight. So we begin as we normally do by doing some preliminary practices. So this basically means we'll do a short meditation and then we'll say the prayers together. So please make yourself comfortable in the seat. Make sure that your back is straight and your shoulders relaxed. And become aware of your breathing. So continue to breathe normally and naturally. And just become aware of the movements that your body makes each time you inhale and exhale. So allow your body, your breathing to be normal. And just noticing the movements that take place and how you feel while you're breathing. So while you're breathing normally and naturally, I want you to imagine that the field of enlightenment appears in front of you. So here we have Shakyamuni Buddha and the different lineages of enlightened beings, all the bodhisattvas and protectors and so forth. Think of them as being figures of light. And surrounding you, I'm sitting on chairs or on the ground, the vast crowd of sentient beings, which include your parents, your family, people you've had misunderstandings and difficulties with, and strangers. I think that what you have in common with one another is a wish to be happy and the desire to avoid suffering. And these are two authentic and natural wishes. But then if we have attachment to just the happiness of this life, remember then, if that is the case, you will not be following the truth that the Buddha taught. You will not be classified as a person of the Dharma. So to transcend the attachment and the striving for just the pleasures of this very life, which are actually the very least we're capable of, we can cultivate four thoughts that will turn our mind towards the truth as the Buddha taught it. And these four thoughts are leisure and opportunity, which will inspire within us an appreciation for the potential we have. Impermanence and death, which will inspire within us a sense of urgency towards the practice. Karmic causality is the third turning, and this inspires agency, the sense that we can do this and we will do this. And the fourth thought that turns the mind towards the truth that the Buddha taught is for us to realize the unsatisfactory nature of cyclic existence. And this will inspire within us a distaste for compulsive existence and a conviction to strive for the truth which will culminate in us going for refuge authentically. So we're not the only ones trapped in cyclic existence. So when we take refuge in the three supreme jewels, we need to take refuge on behalf of every living being who finds themselves within the cycle of confused existence. So let's decide to liberate ourselves and every other living being by abandoning attachment to just this life and to the pleasures of cyclic existence, to our own welfare, and towards grasping at intrinsic reality. And then with the sense that the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are here, we will refresh our refuge by reciting these four lines of refuge and generating a mind of enlightenment. So now breathing in deeply through your nostrils. Exhale through your mouth. And then let's recite this together. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. Now to strengthen and enhance our wish to become enlightened for the sake of others, we'll recite the four immeasurable thoughts together. So may all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. And may all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. Now, the practice of Dharma is basically the abandonment of everything that is that hinders our desire to become enlightened, and the adoption of all the causes that bring about enlightenment for the sake of others. And these are all summed up in a prayer called the Seven Limbs. So we'll recite that now. So at the end, thinking that the Buddhas are and the Bodhisattvas are present, we're surrounded by all living beings. So reverently, I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginning this time and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own merits and those of all others to the great enlightenment. Now we come to make an offering to the field of enlightenment in front of us, the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, and the essence of this is to just let go of grasping at our sense of self being true, the sense that the universe objectively and independently exists from us, and that what we're offering, the mandala, is something that truly exists. So we're letting go of all of that, and that's the essence of the mandala offering. And the point of making the mandala offering is actually so that we can gain realizations and understandings and bring us ever closer to enlightenment. So if you know the mudra, just join your hands together now. So this ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon. I imagine this as a Buddha field and offer it. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Yidam Guru Ratna Mandala Kamayataya. So we've let go of the offering, and it's been accepted by the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, who smile at us in delight. Then they melt into light, and this light dissolves through the crown of your head and comes down to rest at your heart and begins to expand. So your body is now filled with light, and the light seeps out through the pores of your skin and spreads out to the 10 directions of space. And wherever there are sentient beings within space, they are touched by this light and transformed. I think that every being around you is fully enlightened. And now the light begins to withdraw, coming back to your heart center. So I think that you have here all the blessings of the Buddha. They are on your most subtle mental continuum, and you have the possibility within you to listen to these teachings, to adopt them and integrate them, and use them as a means to bring yourself ever closer to enlightenment for the benefit of others. Now breathing deeply through your nostrils, exhale through your mouth, and allow your awareness to be once again brought back into the room and looking at the screen. So welcome everybody. I'll just do this thing now. Is it share screen, Miffy?
Yeah, that's right.
So here we are once again. Doing this DB course, and this time of course we're doing how to develop bodhicitta, and we're up to class 5. So let's have a look at what we've done. In our first class we looked at the three types of compassion. So here, you know, we looked at compassion at the beginning, the middle and end, and we also looked at how the relationship between compassion and mere sentient beings who were qualified by momentariness, meaning change, and non-inherent existence. And bodhicitta was defined as for the sake of others, wishing to attain complete, perfect enlightenment. Now, we've been looking at impartiality and its types. So the term you're probably much more familiar with is the word equanimity. We've mainly been looking at the term described as mere equanimity, sort of a balancing of the mind to prevent social reactivity to those we call friends, enemies, and strangers. Then in the third book, we looked at seven cause and effect method. This is the method put forward by Venerable Artisha, and it's a method that's taught to develop this mind of enlightenment. And then last week we looked at the 9-round meditation on equanimity or equalizing. So it's just sort of based on the dual nature of things and events, and it required us to investigate our innate feelings of self-importance, and for us to realize that there's no actual reason to justify it. Now today, we're going to look at the 5 points of Shantideva's equalizing and exchanging self for other meditation. So this is the second of the common forms of developing and then cultivating bodhicitta. So this practice, of course, came down from Buddha Shakyamuni. It was passed to Manjushri and then to Nagarjuna. From Nagarjuna, it went to Shantideva, then Artisha, and Dromtompa, who was the Atisha's spiritual son. He was a Tibetan and a lay person. And these teachings were passed to him. And he passed on these teachings to Geshe-Potama. Geshe-Potama passed them down to Geshe Langri Tangpa and Geshe Sharawa. And finally, Geshe Sharawa passed them on to Geshe Chekawa and his disciple, Geshe Chobwa. And then it came down to us. Now, this type of practice, equalizing, exchanging self for others, was a secret practice until it reached Geshe Chekawa and Chobwa. So it was secret because it could really, you know, another word for secret they call is ear whispered lineage. And it was held, given, it was only given to one student at a time. So the teacher had to sort of investigate the disciples and see if the disciple was suitable to take this teaching. When it was passed down to Geshe Chekawa, he came across very many obstacles to the practice himself. It took him about 12 to 13 years, I think, for Chekawa to actually learn this. And actually, from my readings, what I can recollect, Geshe Sharawa, Geshe Langri Tangpa, Geshe Chekwa, all these guys took between 12 and 13 years of really hard practice, single-pointed practice on this equalizing, exchanging self for others before they actually got the realization of bodhicitta. So I'm just telling you this so that it's a very advanced practice, actually. So if you're having difficulties yourself, realize that you're not alone in this. All the great people who ever developed it, it's not easy to do. And Chekawa, when he met all these difficulties himself learning this, he decided that the teachings should not be kept secret anymore. They needed to be shared, because if they were lost by his early death or something, that would be the end of this tradition, you know. And he saw, actually, it was so powerful and useful, this teaching, for the lepers. So the lepers, of course, were sort of excluded from Tibetan society. And Chekwa taught the lepers this practice. And one of the results of this practice for them was the leprosy decreased. So they became sort of healthy. And when he saw this, he thought, oh, we just can't keep this hidden anymore. This is such a powerful, good practice for everyone. I want to put it out in the open. And so that's basically what happened. So this is a little background on this, on the lineage and this practice called equalizing and exchanging self for other. Now, there's quite a lot of commentary we can find on this practice. And these are some of the books that I've perused and gone through, and know that there's good material in here. So Steps on the Path to Enlightenment by Geshe Sopa and Path to Enlightenment by Geshe Thupten Loden. These have good in-depth explanations and for this practice, and it's really here within the practice of what they call the Lam Rim. Miles Neal's book called Gradual Awakening is really fantastic. It's really examining the Lam Rim through a neuropsychological lens, which I found very, very interesting and useful. And once again, there's good commentary on this practice and that. The book up the top there called Buddhism by the Dalai Lama and Thupten Chodron. This contains commentary on this practice, and it's very wide-ranging presentation. It's a fantastic book for anyone who is sort of serious about their study of the Buddha Dharma. And in fact, I think anyone who wants to do actually Lam Rim study should read that particular book and the others that are in the series before engaging in more common presentations of the Lam Rim. They're actually written for Westerners, this particular book, as a preliminary to Lam Rim study. And so that's why I recommend it. And I've read them and they're very, very good. His books down here, like Bodhicitta and Achieving Bodhicitta, both have really good commentary on this practice. The Way of the Bodhisattva, it's a phenomenal book, and I've used a lot of quotes from that within this teaching. And the Guru Puja also has quite a large section in it on this practice, giving and taking practice. So let's have a look now at the practice itself. So here are the 5 points of the sequence. So first point, of course, is equalizing self with others. The second is the faults of egocentricity. Also often says, faults of self-cherishing. But egocentricity and self-cherishing are equal. Third is the benefits of cherishing others. Fourth, exchanging concern with just oneself to make a concern for others. And finally, giving and taking. Now, there are only 5 points here. One of the things I'd like you to do in terms of your study and meditation is to be able to memorize the sequence forwards and backwards. One of the easy ways I've found to do this is to just substitute all the writing with signs. So, for instance, equalizing self with others, you just have the equal sign that's in maths. Faults of egocentricity is just a negative sign. Benefits of cherishing others is the plus sign. Exchanging self with others, I just like an X. And giving and taking, an arrow going one way and an arrow going another way. So if you want to start, you just have, just see the equalizing sign, equalizing self with others. Then underneath that is the negative sign. So it goes 1, 2, 3 bars. Oh, that's the faults of egocentricity. Oh, that's the plus sign. Oh, that's the benefits of cherishing others. Then I have an X, like a multiplying sign, exchanging self with others and then giving and taking. This the arrow going forward and the arrow going backward. And you can just go backwards again, giving and taking. Oh, that's the mind, the X sign, exchanging self with others. So then there's the positive sign, benefits of cherishing others. Then there's the negative sign, faults, and finally equalizing. So we should be able to do that. If you can do this, this will be very useful later on when you come to the uncommon method. If you can memorize this method, the points, and the 6 causes and 1 effect method, and then we put them together. So remember here, there's only 5 things here. Everyone can count to 5. So we all know 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. We've already memorized that. So now we just add these other little things. We can all count to 6. And we can count from 6 backwards to 1, 2. So I'm just saying we can all do this. And it's a very good thing to do. Now, as persons aspiring to be bodhisattvas, we not only have to generate the mind of enlightenment by going through these stages, but also we have to become familiar with it and then apply it in all aspects of our lives. And bodhicitta generally refers to this altruistic intention to become enlightened for the benefit of others, but it can also refer to our ultimate bodhicitta. But here we're really focusing on conventional bodhicitta. Before I come to the next stage on the equalizing self with others, does anyone have any questions at all?
No one's put anything in the chat, but I'm hoping that everybody knows where the chat is. If you're new to Zoom, maybe wiggle the mouse over the whole Zoom window and it might appear along down the bottom. But no one's put any questions in the chat yet, Eddie.
So let's move on then to the first stage called the equalizing self with others. So first of all, we have a quote here by Arya Shantideva who says, "When both myself and others are similar in that we wish to be happy, What's so special about me? Why do I strive for my own happiness alone? And when both myself and others are similar and that we do not wish to suffer, what is so special about me? Why do I protect myself and not others? So this basic aspiration to be free of suffering arises in us simply because we are conscious living beings. Along with that comes the conviction that we as individuals have a legitimate right to fulfill that aspiration. Now, if we accept this, then we can relate the same principle to others. And we will realize that everyone shares this basic aspiration too. Now, so I mean, sometimes in the class, some of you might remember, I've asked everybody here, does anybody here want to suffer? And no one puts their hand up. You know, so I go, well, we're all the same, we're equal. Does anybody here like to be happy? And you know, if somebody doesn't ask the question, well, what's happiness? Well, most people put their hand up. So we say, oh, we're equal in that too. But here, you know, so we say, oh, we're the same then. And Chanti Deva is saying, well, what's so special about me? Why do I strive for my happiness alone? And what's so special about me? Why do I protect myself and not others? So these are good questions to ask of ourselves. So this equalization process confronts us with the fact that there's no way we are in any way superior or inferior to any other living being in either our ability or our right to experience happiness or be free from suffering. But in order for this idea to become really effective within us, the knowledge needs to be made more experiential. So we can do this by engaging in the practice called equalizing self with others. And the purpose for that is to inspire like empathy. You know, the idea like we are the same. I'm not inferior to you. I'm not superior to you. In this wish that I have for happiness, in a wish to avoid suffering, in the knowledge that I'm not actually authentically happy. Also, the knowledge that, you know, suffering can be overcome. The causes of suffering can be overcome because they're based in this false idea of how things exist. And each of us has the ability to do that. Each of us has within us an ability to become fully enlightened. So we need to look around at ourselves, our brothers and sisters, our children, our husbands, our partners, and go, yeah, we're the same. And that we have this natural empathy towards others and to everyone, acknowledging that those 5 points I mentioned. You want to be happy, you do not want to suffer, you want to avoid suffering. And I know you're not authentically happy. I know suffering can be overcome. I know each of us has the potential to do that. We have the nature of a Buddha, a fully realized being within us. So we need to have these ideas, and that's what we sort of mean by meditating. So it's sometimes when you sit down on your cushion, just go through those 5 points. You're surrounded by all living beings. You tell yourself, you and I are the same. I am the same as my husband, my children. I am the same in the sense that I wish to avoid suffering. I am the same that I wish to be happy. I am the same, and I don't at the moment possess authentic happiness. But suffering can be overcome, and I can become fully enlightened, just like everyone around me. So now, therefore, I'm taking refuge in the Buddha who taught this, the teachings that show me how to do it, and the spiritual community who are engaged in this practice. Try and use this and come from your heart, Adam. Now, there's a lovely verse in Shanti Davis' Bodhisattva's Way of Life. So it's verse, it's in chapter 8, and it's verse 94. And I'll read it out to you. And if you have this a copy of the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, have a look at it. And I think if you could memorize this verse or those 5 points and say it each day, you know, in the morning, in the afternoon, and try, because this is where it starts with equalizing. If we can't do this, nothing else is going to come. So Shanti Davis says, hence, I should dispel the misery of others because it is suffering, just like my own. And I should benefit others because they are sentient beings just like myself. So all the reasonings and so forth, you come to this, you know. You have those 5 points. All living beings equally wish to avoid suffering. All living beings equally wish to have happiness. All living beings equally lack genuine happiness. The cause of suffering can be eliminated. The potential for a complete, genuine happiness can be actualized. Therefore, I should dispel the misery of others because it is suffering just like my own. And I should benefit others because they are sentient beings just like me. Makes good sense, doesn't it?
Yep, I think so.
Anyway, this is the first step, you know. So whether we generate the sense of equality through this method, or like last week doing the 9 reasonings, or previous to that, the equality that takes away that societal reactivity, you know, so we don't have attachment to friends, animosity or hatred towards enemies, and a sense of just not caring about strangers. Whichever methods we adopt, we need to have a sense of equality between ourselves and a sense of empathy between one another. So, and actually, I remember a story where when Glenn, Alan Wallace was up at Dharamsala, and he undertook the training. He was just given 2 meditations to do by Geshe Nawang Dage, and they were Fortunate Human Rebirth and this equalizing self with other equanimity. And he'd have to go away and do it and come back and then report back to Geshe Nawang Dage. And only when Geshe was happy with his progress, he would give him the next stage to go on with. So I think this is a very good double even for us, isn't it? To appreciate what we have and then see, my gosh, I'm the same as everyone else in terms of wish for happiness, wish to avoid suffering, and acknowledging that our happiness is not actually authentic, long-lasting, and stable. We're the same. So the next step is called looking at the disadvantages of self-preoccupation. So I've called it, you can see I've changed. I went from self-preoccupation. Before I talked about that it was egocentricity. Sometimes it's called self-cherishing. So I like to switch the words around because sometimes they have a deeper impact on my own heart. And you might find the same. If self-cherishing is not doing it for you, because I've often seen in classes where people don't like that word because they think, what's wrong with cherishing myself? You know, so if you go egocentricity or self-preoccupation, where you're just preoccupied with yourself and your own needs and forget about everyone else, then it's good to go, okay, then there are disadvantages to you behaving that way. So the point of reflecting upon these disadvantages is to inspire within us renunciation towards the causes of suffering and compassion for others. Now, when we look, there are many, many disadvantages to self-cherishing, self-preoccupation, egocentricity. And actually, in the first chapter of the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, there's a whole chapter on it to show you. Not the first one. That shows you the advantages of cherishing others. But there are many texts that show these disadvantages. And actually, His Holiness was saying one time, which I've copied out here, he says he often talks to psychologists and scientists and so forth at these mind and life meetings. And he was talking to a psychologist, and it seems indisputable that there is a correlation between early death, high blood pressure, and heart disease on one hand, and a disproportionate high use of the first person pronouns, I, me, and mine. So in other words, we've really focused on self, preoccupied with your own concerns. Some of the things that follow are heart disease, high blood pressure, early death.
Eddie, there's a question from Jen.
Yeah.
So if you're in the shower and washing your big toe, how is anyone in the world going to care about that big toe as much as you? How can I care about your big toe like I care about my big toe? My big toe is always with me.
Yeah, so we're not talking about caring for big toes. We're talking about caring that others experience suffering and wish to be happy, aren't we? So I'm not quite sure what Jen's getting at here.
I was thinking maybe because we care about ourselves and our body and everything because it is always with us. That thought of my body, we care about that, and how could we care about others as much as that, as our own?
By seeing that the body has arisen through suffering. I mean, how have you got this body? How have you come to have this body? You know, you have, if you focus really on the body, then the causes are your parents' lust. Then you look at that, well, like, what is that? You go, well, there's blood and sperm.
So it's
actually not you. Okay, so are you going to say?
So Jen's saying, how do I care about your body as much as mine, which is with me 24/7?
Well, this is going to come up when we talk about the exchange. So here, we've got a couple of more steps to go, Jen, and then we do the exchange. But that's what you're talking about, isn't it? That's what you're getting at. How can I do that? Well, you see yourself as being independent of the other, being separate from them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's you and them, my body, their body. Their body's not my body. I am different. I am here, they are there, all those sort of things, isn't it? So then it's like you say, how can I care for them when it's not mine? Is that right? Am I on the right track?
I think you're on the right track.
Okay, so that's
crucial,
Okay, so we need to take this one here and the next one, and then we'll come to the exchange.
Yep, okay.
Because that allows us to do what you find very hard to do at present, Jen.
Yep, she's all ears, she says.
Okay. So here's a sort of a brief. I'll say some of the faults first of all. And like I said, there's so many of them. So I'll just give you some of these, and then I'll also give you a quick rundown of 10 faults that Lama Zopa has mentioned in his new book, Bodhicitta. Practice for a meaningful life. So this sort of when we use the word self-cherishing here, there's a self, there's a cherishing for self that is correct and not a problem, and there's another one that is a problem, and we're talking about the one that is problematic. So this type of self-cherishing, the wrong form of self-cherishing, makes us stupid, supports disrespect, anger, and worthless activities. It binds us to cyclic existence, inspiring greed and lust. It causes us to experience unhappiness in this very life. It also causes us to perform countless unskillful actions, to conceal our faults, and to experience suffering in the future. It blocks the path to enlightenment. It promotes self-doubt, deluded pride, and wrong views. It's utterly worthless, and it's an unnecessary mental state. So here, so these are just some of them. I'm just going to leave the things that Lama Zopa says, but in those ones, they're really from a Buddhist perspective. You know, like it'll throw you into the lower realms. It's just incredibly problematic to be self preoccupied. And so here's a brief meditation of the analytical sort that His Holiness the Dalai Lama has written has done before, and it's in a book called Becoming Enlightened on page 195. So if you just put yourself at ease, and I'll just say what he's written, and you just contemplate it. So up till now, egocentricity and its partner, ignorance, have taken up residence in the center of your heart. Because its observed object, the inherently established self, does not exist, egocentricity is a wrong awareness. A suitable reason for considering only yourself worthwhile and neglecting everyone else simply does not exist. Despite drawing you into all sorts of actions to bring you happiness, this egocentric attitude has only created a mess. You need to view the self-centeredness of egocentricity as faulty from the very depths of your being. Remember that this wrong form of self-cherishing will make you look stupid. It will support your disrespect for those you hold dearly. It will bring about anger within you, and it will chain you to all the worthless activities that you'll ever engage in this life. So now it's time to leave egocentricity, self-preoccupation, and the self-cherishing mind behind, and instead to take up cherishing others. Now is the time to leave ignorance behind and take up the wisdom that realizes selflessness. I guess just breathe in now. And this is a type of analytical meditation, and it comes through analyzing all the faults of self-cherishing and then coming to this type of conclusion. And then you like read it or listen to it as I've spoken to you. So one more slide on this. So this chronic disease of self-preoccupation is the cause of unwanted suffering. Perceiving this, may I be inspired to blame, begrudge, and destroy this demon of egocentricity. And this is, of course, from the Lama Chopa, and it's verse 91. So here, when I looked at this verse, I've changed some of the words around. I've kept the whole flow of it right, but I've put in words like, put in self-preoccupation. Sometimes it's in there, sometimes it's self-cherishing. So I put, egocentricity, self-preoccupation, to try and get these words to hit your heart from as many directions as I can. That's what I have to do to myself. If you're reading this material and it doesn't affect you, more work has to be done. So this is what Geshe Tashi Tsering says about this, though, in his book, The Awakened Mind, and this is on page 61. He says, having spent our entire life with a self-preoccupying attitude, it can be very frightening to contemplate renouncing it. This is a mind that has continually and obsessively worked for our own happiness. And no matter how much we try to convince ourselves logically that it is a negative mind that will only make us more unhappy, it is nonetheless the only mind we know. In the same way that some people become dependent upon abusive relationships, even though they logically know how damaging they are, we can know that self-preoccupation is damaging and yet still embrace it as if we're a dear lover. He goes on to say, there's no easy fix for this. We need to push our logical understanding deeper and deeper until it does have some effect on the way we live. And this can take a considerable amount of time. And Pabongka Rinpoche, in the book Liberation of the Palm of Your Hand, says, selfishness is like a fire that catches hold and gets bigger and bigger, incinerating our family, our country, and the whole wide world. Selfishness is like a butcher. It slaughters our chance for a high samsaric rebirth, much less the possibility of emancipation, because it destroys our merits. It's the root of negative thoughts, and so eliminates the possibility of doing anything meritorious. It brings us down to the lowest conditions in samsara. This attitude is also like a great thief, in that it robs us of the riches of the happiness of this life, future lives, liberation, and enlightenment. So we'll have a look at what self-cherishing is, just to sort of help you with understanding what it is. So basically it's this, it's a type of craving which clings and holds dearly to the self. So we have a self, right? So that's the first thing to acknowledge. If we try to find out how it exists, we'll find it exists in mere name. It's the name given to the combination of the five aggregates that we normally call the body and mind, right? That's the self. But craving takes that name, self, which has been imputed to the body and mind, and gives it a type of identity that it actually doesn't have. A type of a reality and identity that it doesn't have. And that reality identity is called inherent existence. And it's from that, thinking that we actually inherently exist, that this egocentricity arises. Self-centeredness and so forth.
Eddie, can you hang on a second? There's some weird distortion with
this. Yeah, I hear it.
It's not you turning your pages?
No, I can hear it without doing that.
Okay, hang on. Radio. Yep, go for it. It's okay. Fixed it.
So, we've called it self-cherishing, egocentricity, self-preoccupation. And here's another word called self-centeredness. So self-centeredness, it's a nice word for this term, for this self-cherishing or grasping itself. Self-centeredness is a type of desirous attachment which clings to the I and mind. Grasping the I is existent from its own side, or in other words, a craving which holds dearly to the self is the self-centered attitude. And it's a wrong consciousness which holds or which shares similarity with both the innate view of the transitory collection, which is the root of all of our problems, and the pride which is directed at I.
Eddie, there is also a question here when you were saying about how self-cherishing brings so much suffering and is, you know, is, but is there not unwanted suffering in cherishing others as well?
In the beginning, yes, because you're not skilled at it. If you don't have wisdom, and if you do, and if you haven't actually become very, very certain of how just cherishing yourself harms you, right? So you need those two first. Then when you come to look at cherishing others, we'll see all the benefits of that. And once you look at those benefits, they will, what can I say, prevent a lot of the sufferings that come from cherishing others. Right, so this is, you'll see that this is a, you'll see that these 5 points, these 5 stages are a process, a movement from one to the other. When we don't do that and we just try to cherish others without having a foundation, yes, it'll hurt. The wonderful thing here with, you'll see later, well, I hope you'll see, is that this hurt is not a bad thing. It's a good thing. That what we call suffering is a sort of sense of hurt that goes with it. And normally we don't like to be hurt, but here you can like it. In fact, you can actually cherish it. And we actually need that hurt. It's like experiencing pain when the body is hurt. You know, that's not a bad thing. That's a good thing. So here we say we get hurt. What's being hurt when we cherish others is self-cherishing. Not the I, not the me, but the self-cherishing. That's what doesn't like it. Egocentricity doesn't like it.
So it's a little bit like feeling the burn.
Yeah, we've got to put the hurt where it belongs here. Yeah, and so when you don't know that, of course, then we take the hurt from cherishing others. You know, they don't appreciate it. They do things that are hurtful to us, and we take it on us, on ourselves. But that's not where the hurt should go. The hurt should be put elsewhere. So that's possible to do that. You know, we can be skillful about that. But that's coming up shortly. So I might just leave it. I've got much more to say and talk about this. But instead of doing it, I'll give you the book that's very useful, a book called Transforming the Heart by Geshe Tegchok. So that really is a lot of great material in there for describing what self-cherishing is and the faults of it and so forth. But we'll move on because let's have a look. Yeah, we better move on. We've got half an hour or so to go. So there are all these synonyms for self-cherishing. So I've been mentioning them, you know. We call it self-centered, and it's a butcher. It destroys happiness, as Pabongka Rinpoche said. It's self-preoccupation. It harms us because we're blind to the facts that others are suffering just like us and wish to be happy just like us. But we are blind to that. We focus just on ourselves. Egocentric. It's the troublemaker. So, yeah, I like this word because many, many years ago I was in trouble. I'd made trouble for myself through my egocentricity and found myself in a court. And the judge said to me, "You are the most egocentric person I've had in my court in the last 20-something years." Right? And I was so shocked. And I thought, but isn't everyone like me? I better check this word out, what this word egocentric is, you know. So when I got to jail and I got a dictionary and read about it, I thought, yeah, I am. It is all about me. But I thought everyone's like that. Or not everyone. Of course they aren't, but nearly everyone I knew was about that. So what's the big deal? So it is a troublemaker, I can tell you that from my own experience. And it robs you of happiness. it seems to support your wish for happiness. Just be happy. But along with it comes a lot of problems. So here from Gissi Tegchok, he says, being irritable, lashing out at others, and even being predisposed to violence towards others is due to our long familiarity with the self-centered attitude over countless previous lives. Experiencing fear, being worried about our reputation, craving praise, and fearing blame are also due to self-preoccupation. There are times when we worry about our relationships, feeling uncertain and insecure about whether others will like us and if our friendships will last. Other times, we become close to people really quickly, and then our dissatisfied, fickle mind terminates the relationship without warning. All this comes from self-centeredness. So, you know, we have this predilection to blame ourselves. But here we can blame self-cherishing, because that's actually the troublemaker. You know, like, we have a wish for happiness. We have a wish to avoid suffering. Self-cherishing comes along and says, I'll do that for you, Ed. Just leave it up to me. But all this trouble comes. And that's an attitude, right? Self-cherishing, self-centeredness, these are attitudes. They're wrong attitudes. So they can be dropped. But the person who wants to be happy and not to experience, and wants to avoid suffering, and acknowledges that their happiness is not authentic, knows that the causes of suffering can be abandoned, and has Buddha nature, that person's fine. This is a conventionally existent person. We don't need to put all the crap on him or her. Now, we need to put it where it belongs, which is types of consciousnesses that make problems for us. So finally, I'll say once again from Geshe Tegchok, we accuse self-centeredness of so many wrongs, identifying it as the culprit who is responsible for everything that goes wrong in all our lives. At the same time, we encourage ourselves to allow only the mind cherishing others to arise. When we think about the disadvantages of being preoccupied with ourselves and the advantages of cherishing others, our mind will become very peaceful and happy. Now, I'll tell you now, you won't know this unless you do it. If we do not think in this way, if we receive 1,000 initiations, hear a lifetime of teachings, offer many mandalas, hear many praises and do thousands of prostrations and so on, none of it will be beneficial. He says, although they still have some use, they don't bring great benefit. But if we train our mind in seeing the faults of self-preoccupation, then we become extraordinarily wise. We stop fighting the world in a futile attempt to have everything and everyone conform to your ego's desire. And when you go through difficult situations or problems with finances, relationships, or health, the mind will not be disturbed. So in terms of us trying to practice, so I'm reading material out to you, showing you slides. From your side, you'll need to also read and listen to other teachers talk about these five stages of practice and this practice called equalizing, exchanging self for others. You'll need to think about it and then try to put it into practice. Now, this one here about self-cherishing, or looking at these terms, these synonyms. So, yeah, you can play these little games with yourself, which I've brought up in class sometimes. This is, why don't you just go into work one day and spend the first hour being completely self-centered and not caring about what anyone else wants or does? Or come home to your family and be completely self-preoccupied and see if it actually brings about a happy environment and a happy home or a happy job. I can assure you it won't. People find it very difficult to deal with narcissistic people, people who are so self-centered that you are barely on the radar or that you're only there for their benefit. So just as you won't like others being like this, believe me, they don't like it when you're like that. So if you can see these faults and then have a look at the other side, you know, so that doesn't work. Yeah, I mean, when I first heard this and you go through this and you go, well, that doesn't work. You know, the light goes on and go, geez, what would happen if you did the opposite? So that'll lead us to the next slide. So here is this lovely quote from 7-Point Mind Training by Geshe Chekwa. He says, you know, banish the one object of all blame. So whenever you have difficulties, put the blame on that object, right? The self-cherishing mind, and banish it. That's where the blame belongs. It's not on you. Don't put it on yourself. You're a person who wants to be happy. Why on earth put more suffering on yourself who wishes to be happy? I mean, we do, I know, but it's not wise. It contradicts our deepest wishes, but that's what we do. So when he says banish this one object, he's like saying get rid of self-cherishing, drop the self-cherishing. Like, how can you do that? You go meditate on the great kindness of all. That's how it's done. You'll see everybody is incredibly kind to me. Whatever they're doing, it's a great kindness. So I should not reject them or be hostile towards them and so forth.
Eddie, I just think that is mind-blowingly amazing, because often then when you hear that one of, if you can hear the one of banish the blame onto self-cherishing, which is difficult to hear it anyway, but then when you do, it's kind of like with this thought of hatred of self-flagellation or blaming yourself. But when you said meditate on the how to do it, meditate on kindness, it's completely different.
So we used to have a translator called Ruth, and this teaching was given to myself, her, and another student. And Ruth found this practice so hard to do. Then she went overseas and became a translator. I remember the first thing she said when she came back, she said, "This is a very high practice." And I think, yeah, that's why it was secret for so long. You know, they only give it out to one person at a time that the teacher thought, you know, you're a suitable vessel sort of thing. And you've got to remember here that these teachings, there's a huge foundation beneath them. There is the lower scope and the middle scope. So they're to bring about, you know, renunciation on our side, renunciation. So in other words, stop hurting yourself. Stop creating negative karma. Stop creating unskillful negative karma that hurts you and hurts others. Put this blame on what actually caused the blame, you know, self-cherishing. And how to do that, how to sort of see that that's the object and not other people. You think by thinking of the great kindness of all and becoming really familiar with it and cultivating your understanding of it. So, you know, remember in the other practice, Six Causes and One Effect, we started off on loving kindness first, then we went to compassion. Right, so this is where, you know, meditating on the great kindness comes in. So it really is a step-by-step process if we really wish to have it, you know, cultivate it within our own mind stream and become persons of great kindness, persons of great compassion. So I'll just say a couple of things about as a commentary. This So this is from the Dalai Lama from a book called Path to Bliss, and it's on page 165. He says, it's the self-preoccupying attitude that is the source of all miseries, and therefore is the only object to be blamed for all misfortune. So like when you experience suffering, don't put it on yourself, don't put it on the other. So that's the fault of self-cherishing. It is the only object to be blamed for all misfortune. His Holiness goes on to say, normally, because of our self-righteousness, it's quite natural for us to blame others when something happens that we do not like, such as problems, suffering, and so forth. We immediately blame it upon others. But if we think in real terms, we find that all the problems and undesirable experiences come about because of the kind of body that we have assumed, the body that is contaminated and a product of actions and delusions. We possess such a body because of our attachment to self. It is attachment and grasping at the self that gives rise to all these undesirable sufferings. Then Miles Neal says from Gradual Awakening on page 144, now this contemplation is an analytic reality check on our neuroses. Consider this matter not from a faith or dogma perspective, but using objective reasoning. Trace all your misery to its source, and you will find it arises from self-preoccupation and self-protectiveness within the hallucination of separateness. Isn't that a beautiful sentence? Arises from self-preoccupation and self-protectiveness within the hallucination of separateness. So when I'm thinking right now, I think this is why I think, you know, wonderful thing about the practice of the Buddha Dharma and how it's rooted in wisdom. That our ethics come out of wisdom, of knowing how things exist. It depends upon that, we engage in a path. So now let's have a look at this third step, the cherishing others, the benefits of cherishing others. And if we look at what is the purpose for doing that, it is to do this. Inspire your own cherishing love. So Kensa Rinpoche used to call this like a sense of warmth, but also protectiveness. Sort of warm protectiveness. So affectionate love is like, so we have affectionate love, and then we have cherishing love, and then after comes a wishing love in terms of the progression of how love is also developed. So here we're very concerned about the fact that others want to be happy and yet they're not. So what are the benefits of this cherishing? First of all, that it's required to attain enlightenment. It'll lead to your own enlightenment. But even on a mundane level, there are many, many benefits for developing a mind that cherishes others. For instance, many of our anxieties and daily fears will diminish and vanish over time when you start to work for others because you cherish them. I think one of the great examples of a person who developed the cherishing mind is Mother Teresa. And one of the ways she did that was each sentient being, she saw each beggar, each person suffering from leprosy, anyone who's suffering, she cherished them because she could see that this was actually Christ themselves in a distressing disguise. Now, this is a very skillful means, great skillful means. Yeah, our one, which we forget, of course, is that we think, we look at sentient beings and we forget, that's a future Buddha. If that person becomes enlightened before me, they'll be helping me. Why should I not cherish them now? So our enlightenment comes about through the cherishing of others. So some of the benefits are fear diminishes, anger vanishes, it's the supreme health, you become a refuge for others. Isn't that wonderful? To become a refuge for others, and others can go to you and seek safety and help because they know you cherish them. So Geshe-Tashi Tsering says from the awakened mind, if we spend an hour of our time helping others, we might find we have less time for others. Or if we give to a charity, there might be a bit less money left at the end of the month. Some surfaced difficulties may arise when we actively try to be less selfish. But at a deeper level, particularly at a psychological level, the benefits don't stop. Long term, they are enormous. And some of you will remember the verse in Shanti Deva's Bodhisattva's Way of Life. So once again, this is from chapter 8, and this is from verse 129. He says, whatever worldly joy there is arises from wishing for others' happiness. Whatever worldly suffering there is arises from wishing for your own happiness. So if you've ever, and I'm sure we all have done this, you know, just gone for what we wanted. Right? The other is secondary. I'd suggest, of course, that this changes greatly when women become mothers. Right? So even the process of being pregnant and then giving birth to the child and looking after them for so many years, women put themselves second. I think fathers find themselves, it's not so easy to do that. And then they find, of course, they're you know, second to their children, and it's difficult for them. And this is, of course, because of selfishness. Yeah. So it's a terrific verse, eh? Whatever worldly joy there is, or whatever happiness there is, arises from wishing for others' happiness. Whatever suffering there is, arises from wishing for your own happiness. So once again, in your readings and so forth, become familiar with the benefits of cherishing others. Because without that sort of knowledge, you'll find it very difficult and hard to do. So you need the two things, the faults and the benefits. So once again, there's a quote from the Lama Chipa. Panchen Lama Jerky Gelson says, self-preoccupation is the doorway to all downfalls, while cherishing my mothers is the foundation of everything good. Inspire me to make the core of my practice the yoga of exchanging myself for others. So in relationship to that, in terms of commentary, it's we suffer, others suffer. We should work diligently to eliminate suffering simply because it is suffering. And not because it is our suffering or their suffering. And we should certainly not try to eliminate our own suffering at the expense of someone else's happiness. Now, I will know many, many, many people who do that. At present, I'm reading a book called Look What You Made Me Do. And that's a book about domestic abuse and domestic violence. And it's shocking. But you know, the whole thing there is that these men and women are willing to cause suffering for others so that they can feel content and happy. And it's really sort of obvious and sort of really shocking when you, I mean, since I've been reading this book, it's very difficult to read. But I found it very useful to feel those difficulties and take them on and go, this is my, you know, my self-cherishing and do giving and taking meditations on it. It's a fantastic book for that, that's for sure. So we need to sort of look back over our lives and see if this is true. And in dependence upon that, gradually make this exchange. Stop caring so much just about ourselves at the expense of others. And I said, this really comes out when we, the preliminary meditation on the equality of self and others. So let's have a look now. And boy, this is the next part's really for you, Jen, and of course anyone else, because this is, we need to exchange our self-concern, our concern for just ourselves, for another attitude which is concern for others. And what does this actually do? It inspires courage. Because it is, you know, we need courage to engage in this path, and this does it. This really supports courage and inspires it. In brief, it's to do this. Cherish others as you presently do yourself, and then neglect yourself as you presently do others. In other words, you sort of reverse your former attitude. So Lama Tsongkhapa in his Lamrim Chenmo says, reflect thoroughly on the benefits of being other-centered and the faults of being self-centered. By doing so, you will produce from the depths of your heart a great delight in meditating on the exchange of self and other. Then recognize that you can generate it once you've become habituated to it. So you can do it again and again and again. So remember here, we're viewing egocentricity as the enemy. His Holiness says, you must develop a conviction that there's no practice superior to the practice of exchanging oneself for others. And this is the essence of all the teachings. In fact, if anyone has read the background to 7-point mind training, now this is what happened with Geshe Chekwa. He found this that little piece of writing, a little note that said something like, take all the sufferings of others upon yourself and give your happiness away to others. And he thought, what? I've never ever heard of this, anyone say this before. And yet it was on his teacher's desk, you know. So he went and said, is this a teaching of the Buddha? And he's gone, yes, it is. Well, I've never ever heard of anybody ever say anything like that. Of course, because this was secret at the time. You know, so then Geshe Chekwa went searching for somebody who could teach it to him. He went looking for Geshe Langri Tangpa. Geshe Langri Tangpa just passed away, but he found Geshe Sharawa. He spent 13 years with him to develop this practice of exchanging self for others and then engaging in the giving and taking. So I like this when it says to inspire courage, because it gives us the idea of this is what I'm doing. You know, becoming a more courageous person. This practice will help me do that. But because I know that many of us have got so many fears. You know, but if you really sort of, some of them are unnecessary. And the other thing I'd say to you about courage is that when you realize that it is the false self and the mind that cherishes that false self is the root of our suffering, then surely you can, seeing that it's a falsity, that it doesn't actually exist truly, wow. It's like, sure, you don't need a lot of courage. All you have to really do is accept it. Discover it, accept it, and then go, okay, it's just a habit of grasping itself. It's just this habit of being self-preoccupied and egocentric. It's a habit. I need to break that habit. So in many ways, you know, we need some sort of courage to do it. And I said, you know, it's being done right now. People are doing this practice right now, and others have already done it. So we can have a go at it. Now, there are some problems about doing this, of course. So let's have a look at this. And here, Jen, I hope this will help you now. And if it doesn't, I can give you the sources for it so you can look and think more deeply about it. So the first problem is this, right? We think that self and other are different in the same way that blue and yellow are different. And so this is what I'm suggesting, the way you're thinking about yourself and others, Jen, right? Your body, your sufferings are different to anybody else's in the same way that the two colors, blue and yellow, are different. Now, there's no way that blue is yellow, is it? And there's no way that yellow is blue. Those two colors are different. And we think of ourselves and our sufferings in the same way. So what we're doing here is we're making a categorical differentiation between people who are happy or suffering, making them as different as blue and yellow. And it depends upon that, we accomplish our own happiness and remove our own suffering because we think of them as mine. And we neglect others' happiness and suffering because of thinking they belong to you. They're your problem, belonging to them, right? Therefore, the remedy for this is to not make that categorical distinction between self and others as being essentially different. Rather, you need to understand that self and other are mutually dependent, such as that when you are aware of self, you are aware of other. And when you are aware of other, you're aware of self. Now, this problem here was looked at last week, where we looked at the problem trying to develop equanimity in terms of from the ultimate point of view. So here, to support this, that we're not categorically different. It's like being aware of near mountains and distant mountains. Relative to your being here, you think of a mountain there in the distance as being a distant mountain. Yet when you go to the distant mountain, you think of it as a near mountain. And the other mountain is now distant. So the awareness of self and other is not like the awareness of these colors. For regardless of what the color blue is related to, you are aware of just blue. And you're not aware of some other color. No, it's just blue. But self exists in dependence upon other. And other exists in dependence upon self. So there's a relationship there, an interdependent relationship. And Jen, so what makes us very different, I says, like grasping at the self or grasping at the body as being me and independent of the other, completely different. So Arishanti Davis said, in relation to this, self and others are dependently established. They are false, meaning they don't truly exist. Like this shore and the other shore. That shore is not in itself the other shore. In relation to someone else, it is this shore. The self is not established in and of itself. In relation to someone else, it is other. If you can get your head around this, you need to think deeply about it and consistently. Then you can see how you can actually make the exchange, swap over the self and other. Because self and others don't independently truly exist. They exist in mere name. They're just names put onto things. You know, if you think like, say, my body. But the body that you have actually is only yours because of the label my put on it. It actually came from your mother and your father. So really, doesn't it belong to them? It's theirs, their sperm, their blood. So it's my because of the label on it.
So Eddie, Jen is saying, for instance, but others have died of COVID-19, but I haven't. So how do I feel the same? Or my death is not your death and your death is not my death.
Yep, that's right. So, and that's right. So that's how you conventionally exist, right?
And so then how do I feel the same?
By realizing that you too will die, that there's all these similarities. You lack a truly existent self. You are impermanent. You will die. That's how you're the same. So it's not that you are the other, are you? The other person has died of COVID-19 and here you still are alive. So it's not that you like are them. But self and other are interchangeable. From the perspective of the other person, you are other. From your perspective, they are other. From your perspective, you are self. From their perspective, they are self. So you're the same. Two selves, two others. Existing dependently upon one another. So like I say, this is not, this takes time to get your head around, and you'll need to find texts that are presented in different ways so you can find your way into it. But it really comes down to, first of all, identifying what you're not. When you find that you are not truly existing inside a body as something or as the body, then what are you? How do you exist? Then you come to mere name, self, other, names.
So, Eddie, then this is my question. With this experience of coronavirus and so many people affected by it, it becomes, because it's kind of novel and immediate, it does become apparent that, you know, that could be me. And so why this artificial distinction between me is important and the others is not?
Yeah. And so, which brings us to the next slide. So here's the second problem, which has become, rampantly obvious at this time, right? Your suffering does not harm me. It's not my problem. Mm-hmm. However, we go, hang on a minute, that's just not true. The suffering of everyone else who has COVID-19 can harm me. So it is my problem. So the second obstacle to training in the practice of exchanging self and other is thinking that other person's misery does not affect me. So why should I do anything about it? It's someone else's problem. And so you do not try to dispel others' sufferings and problems because they don't harm you. And this is a common attitude. The Buddhist response is another analytical meditation directed against believing in an ultimately existent inherent self. Thinking that we do not need to help others because the self and other are separate is as ridiculous as thinking our hand does not need to pull a thorn from our foot because they're different entities. Does it make sense in relation to oneself to think, since a completely different person will exist in the future, why should I worry about looking after or saving money for retirement?
So Pauline has also, just a little while ago, written up, which is very close to this. So she was saying, I don't want to suffer and I want happiness. Therefore, others don't want to suffer and they want happiness.
That's right. That's quite correct, Pauline. That's right. Then, then move to the next, Okay. What can I conclude from that? Gosh, in the same way I try to make myself happy, I need to try and make others happy because we're the same. In the same way that I wish to avoid suffering, others do too. Shouldn't I also help them avoid suffering, seeing we are the same? So this is from the Lamrim Chenmo. He says, if we were to become conditioned to the truth that the self, oneself, and the self of others must be imputed to a collection and a continuum. So that self and other are not established by way of an essence or entity that can be posited independently. This would support the change in attitude needed. So that's what I'm saying. We've really got to work, determine how we actually exist. Without that, it's really problematic to do this type of meditation. And that's why this was, this was kept secret for a long, long time. There's many, many people did not have the courage, the strength, the compassion, and the wisdom to do something like this. So I was like, you can imagine a teacher having 200 students and just giving it to one. You know, or looking through them all. I think it was Geshe Shara or Geshe Chakwa gave it to two students, They're both brilliant scholars. But at the same time, we asked them to keep it secret. So this is not easy to do, but it's easier for people who are, smart, bright. So this type of this meditation is primarily for those of high intellectual regard, where six causes of one effect is more for the emotional aspect.
So this one's really based on quite rigorous reasoning.
Reasoning, that's right. And for those who aren't able to do it, of course, it's problematic, so then I could do the other one.
And so that's why we have to do it in its right order.
That's right. And that's why the other one is much more commonly given. The six causes and one effect. That was the normal way of, generating bodhicitta. And this one was kept secret, like I said. But, I can't get my head around it. Well, guess what? The lepers in that hut that Geshe Chekhova taught, they weren't going to school. They didn't need a great deal of a great scholarly approach to it. And remember a few years ago when AIDS was quite prevalent, when one of Lama Zopa's students who had HIV practiced this practice, equalizing and exchanging, and then giving and taking. And his all the symptoms of HIV fell away, and he didn't get AIDS. And when Lama Zopa asked him, how many times did you do it? He just said, the once. And then Lama Zopa said, it must have been a really intense, heartfelt practice. That's right, it must have been, because if you have doubts, it's not going to be effective. Anyway, so it's really rooted in wisdom, this type of practice, the equalizing, exchanging self for others. So I'm going to, we've really come to the end here. Next week, we're just going to focus on this. I think it's next week. Let's have a look.
Eddie, won't there be the next week on the next slide?
Yeah, that's right. So in summary, we've really just looked at these first four points, right? There's a number of difficulties here. The first, of course, is the equalizing first, and then comes the exchanging. The exchange really is highly dependent upon your understanding of how self exists. That it exists in a mere name as a dependent arising, as an imputation. And other does too. Everything does. Body, everything. So, in brief, we've gone through these five stages. So I can, the fifth stage, which we're going to be doing next week, of course, is the giving and taking. We finished off here with exchanging self with others. And before that came the benefits of cherishing others. And before that came the faults of egocentricity. And we began with equalizing self and others. And this self-preoccupation, self-cherishing, egocentricity is actually a craving which is clinging and holding dearly to the false idea of self, to a false self, which we believe to be true. And there are many disadvantages to self-preoccupation. Anxiety, sickness, high blood pressure, unhappiness, early death are just some of the disadvantages. So perhaps what you could do during the week is just keep an eye out and see the self-cherishing arise. Try to identify it. And when you do experience different forms of suffering during the week, like put it on that. Don't blame yourself or don't blame the other person. So the root of this is self-cherishing and self-grasping. Self-cherishing is buddy, self-grasping. And here is, have a look at this material to help support tonight's class. Now we have all this material up in the members area. What's the section? What's the place called, Miffy?
It's just called Course Notes. It's in the resources tab on the website.
Yeah. So this is, we've got 01, pages 29 to 41, 74 to 86. The section called 03, Meditation on Generation of Bodhicitta and Exchange of Self. And 07 is a Tonglen Meditation. Next week we're going to look at this uncommon method of Lama Tsongkhapa, where you combine the two methods together.
So we need to dedicate, just stop the screen share when you do the dedication. Okay. Great.
So
let's dedicate.
Dedicate what we've done tonight. So I think that due to the past, present and future merits, which are like a dream and exist in mere name, which have been created by myself, the Buddhas, the Bodhisattvas and sentient beings, who also exist like dreams and exist in mere name. May I attain enlightenment, which exists in mere name, and lead all dream-like sentient beings who exist in mere name to that enlightenment, which is like a dream and exists in mere name, and may I do it by myself alone, which, not existing from its own side, exists in mere name. So thank you, everybody. Good luck, good reading, and let's try and cherish others throughout the week.